From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a young boy in the south of Sudan was only 9 years old. And that's when war came to Sebastian Marundit's village. He saw things that no child should ever see. Violence, murder, the targeting of family members. Sebastian fled with his cousin to Ethiopia, but 4 years later, war found them again, and the boys headed out to walk across the desert to a Kenyan refugee camp. They never gave up. After nearly a decade, they were selected for resettlement in the United States. They would get college degrees, build successful lives here, but Sebastian and his cousin never stopped thinking about their home in South Sudan. Their home village had no roads, no clean water, and no school for children. So these two men, these refugees, launched an effort to change that. They created an organization called Building Minds in South Sudan. Their nonprofit has now helped hundreds of people, but it's been about 5 years since WXXI sat down with Sebastian at length here. And today, South Sudan is still struggling with a desperate situation. The International Crisis Group says that a staggering 7.1 million of South Sudan's 12 million strong population are acutely hungry. Many kids still aren't going to school. Clean water is a challenge. Sebastian is in Rochester, but spends a lot of his time on the road, and this is our opportunity to learn what he's been doing, how severe the needs are, and what their next goals are in this organization. Let me welcome Sebastian Marundit, who's the co-founder and president of Building Minds in South Sudan. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Deb.
And let's also welcome Judy Schwartz, board chair for Building Minds in South Sudan. Thank you for being here, Judy.
Thank you for having us.
There's a lot to cover this hour, and I hope listeners will stay with us. We're going to talk about some very difficult things to hear, but these are the kinds of things that people need to hear as some people in our studio work on making real, real change. Sebastian, your story is, it's pretty well known to some Rochesterians, but it might have been a while since our listeners have heard it. And can you kind of reintroduce yourself and take us back a little bit about, maybe take me back to your first memories of childhood. What are your first memories of childhood?
My first memories is in childhood is playing with my little sister that was later on, her life was taken by war. And I was 9 years old before I left the village. So it was a sweet life story.
Until war came
to the village.
You had a childhood that you liked.
Yeah, and then that has changed. That has changed to worse. And fortunately, I was one of those who were selected to have come to the United States after 18 years in the struggles.
And you came to the United States. What are your first? What were your first thoughts coming to Rochester?
Well, I was confused. It took me 5 years to adjust. First thing was food itself. American food and what I was eating at refugee camp was completely different. I thought it was like I was in second heaven, I should say, because of this light, simple things that you may learn when you are 3 years old. I was learning when I was 21 years old, including turning a modern light off and on and then using a modernized toilet. It was a life shocking. It took me 5 years. And then also, there was no vocabulary to describe snow. They didn't tell me there's something called snow in America. I have to learn in a hard way. So these were challenging. And then after I spent 5 years in America, went back to South Sudan with my cousin, Mathon Noy. Fortunately, I met my mom again after many years, but I was not able to see my father again. He lost his life during war as well. The situation in the village was horrible. All the schools were destroyed, including churches as well. So I took my, that time he was 16 years old, brother of mine, took him to Kenya to go to school in Nairobi. And a child in the village asked me, "What about us? You are taking your brother to Kenyan school. What about us?" There were 20 children in that under tree school, I still remember, in one classrooms. I didn't answer that question. If I say yes, then I would have cost me a lot of money to take 20 children to Kenya. And if I say no, then I turned them down. They didn't ask for shoes or clothes. They asked for an access to school. So we came back to the United States, and with help from Judy Chord and many board members, we created a nonprofit called Building Mine in South Sudan. We went back to the village to answer that question, to build one school for the community. That didn't end there. We built the first schools, and there were 959 children including 300 girls. So we thought girls were not enough. So we created a second school only for girls, because in that culture, education for girls is not that much. Culturally, they were blocked. And so we asked ourselves, are we going to allow a different generation to be like my mother? Because she was not allowed to go to school. So we created a second school for girls, and about 800 girls joined that school. It was amazing. And then after two elementary school, which is 1 to 8, we decided to build a high school. So when they finish 8th grade, they will go to high school. So that high school was built. It was named, first name was Main Central High School, and then the community changed it to an elder American professor who visited village, Bill Cook from SUNY Geneseo. So we built Bill Cook High School, and that was co-op, still is. And then 3 years later, we created another school, high school for girls. And now we have 722 girls at the girl high schools. These 700 girls, 40 of them are from country of Sudan, refugees from Sudan, 40 girls from Sudan. So this is what we have been doing. And now we plan to build a pre-K to third grade in the community so we can leave space for the grown children to go to this two primary schools and have the little one go to pre-K to third grade.
So that's what they're working on next. They want to build. They want construction to start on a pre-K to third grade school in Mayanabun. Mayanabun, is that right?
Correct. Mayanabun.
Mayanabun.
Yeah.
In South Sudan.
Yeah. Before 1948, it used to be known as Mayan Anyar. But it changed. Abun is mean a Catholic mission. That's what it means. Abun is like a Catholic priest. So it changed from Mayan Anyar to Mayan Abun.
And that's where the school would be. Now, I'm curious to know, Sebastian, your mother was not allowed to go to school.
Yes.
The culture has not been very welcoming to girls in school. Is that changing, or is there any resistance to having girls go to school there?
The leadership of a country, the president of a country, is pushing for all the children to go to schools. But culture is still pushing girls behind. And we are lucky enough to have...
That's okay. His phone never stops ringing.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
And with that, we want to use that chance, seeing the country leadership is pushing for girls and all children to go to schools. We want to use that chance to create more educational access for girls. Because by educating girls, you educate the community.
And so... How long has it been since, well, you mentioned Bill Cook High School. I mean, how long have they been in existence now?
12 years.
Well, the first school was completed in 2012.
2012.
So it's really a short 12 years. And he didn't mention, but we started building for 249 boys and build it and they will come. And as parents saw the building going up, more enrolled their children. So by the time the school was completed, we had 959 students in a school built for 249. So the rooms were really equipped for bringing in 25 children. We upped it to 50 in a room, and they went on double session in order to accommodate them all. And it's remarkable, you know, that we went from such a small number to a huge number in a very, very short period of time.
There's so many questions that come to mind. We're going to go in a lot of different directions here, but one that comes to mind first for me. When Sebastian describes going back for your brother and the 20 other boys who said, what about us? We want a school. We want a chance to learn. A lot of United States kids roll their eyes at school. They don't want to get on the bus. They don't want to go to school today. And I think it is pretty easy to take for granted something that seems like you are entitled to it and you will always have it. If you grow up without it, it must be viewed entirely differently. And it sounds, Sebastian, like that's exactly what you found.
Well, actually, it's completely different because here you don't see sufferings. You don't see the difference between an intellectuals, educated community and non-educated community. So I don't really blame children here. They don't see the difference. If you go to the village, and those who are educated coming from town to visit the village, the life is different. And children understand the reason they are in that situation is because their parents are not educated. So to change that situation, each and every child understands they have to go to school. And this is why they walk. Some children can walk up to 3 miles, one way to school. Some children even don't have shoes on to go to school. They walk barefoot. But they see the future. Right now we have two teachers in our high school that went to our first primary school. They went to universities. One went to Upper Nile University in South Sudan and one to Juba University. And they came back. They're now one is teaching biology and the other one is teaching math in our high school. So within less than, because he was six, one was sixth grader and the other one was seventh grader. Within less than 20 years, they came back to the community and helped the community. And each and every child see the difference. They were here with us, and now they are back, educated and helping the community. They're teaching, they're being paid to teach, and that is impacting their own community.
I mean, it's a remarkable story, but you are saying that kids in South Sudan, they know that the path to a more comfortable life is through school. Yes,
it's a walk to school.
And they will walk. They will do what it takes.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you, as a child, don't come back again, I don't want in this school, they will cry.
Oh.
Yes. I wish I could take children here, those who don't want to go to school, to go and see the difference there. Then they will not take it for granted. But again, I don't blame them because...
different circumstances.
When you eat sweet thing every day, you think that it's sweeter thing on the other side of the world. If you eat a good food every day, you want more good, better than that, right? In that part of the world, you don't have access to anything. You don't have clean water at home. You don't have lights. You don't have anything.
You don't have a grocery store.
Nothing.
No.
And then someone is telling you at the school site that if you finish your schools, you will be like those in towns that have motorcycles, that are able to pay for food and pay for water. So they see this is then the way forward. This is the only way out to the light.
Mm. If you want to learn more about Building Minds in South Sudan as we go throughout this hour, where can people get online and learn more about what you're doing?
Very simple. BMISS, BMISS.org brings you to our website.
BMISS.
Building Minds in South Sudan.
Yep. BMISS, BMISS.org. And I like to say that at WXXI, I can urge people to become a member of public radio. I can't urge you to do anything else with your dollars, but I can give you space for to hear from some of our panelists because you have some needs, don't you?
Definitely.
What are your needs?
Well, as Sebastian said earlier, we do need funds to build the pre-K through third grade school. It's remarkable. The women in the village build the bricks by hand and they're ready. We have pictures of the pile of bricks ready. We need the funding for the builder to come in and actually construct the school. So that's where our need is right now. And we're hopeful because there is such a need for it. And we'll see. I just want to go back to one thing you were talking about with Sebastian and the students. When he goes out to speak, and we were just at Gananda the other day, he makes a huge impact when he talks about the difference between the kids that he's speaking to and those in the village. And he always says, you don't know how lucky you are. And then he sort of ticks off what it's like to go to school there. And it's incredible. I mean, I can attest to it. It's under tree school. And the students sit on the dirt and their fingers, their pencil, and the dirt's their paper. They walk 3, 4, 5 miles barefoot on a stony dirt road. There's no water. There's no food. And it was 110. And this is what children endure until they have, you know, someone like Sebastian who really just changed their lives. It's incredible.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Let me also just mention here that I think it will be useful to hear from both of our guests a little bit of history and a little bit of understanding because I struggle with this. Sudan is not South Sudan. And the circumstances in Sudan vis-a-vis South Sudan are quite different. Now, I'm going to read first from a report from the International Crisis Group that came out last week. But then I'm going to ask our guests to talk more about this and help us understand, because you're going to keep hearing Sudan or South Sudan and don't don't conflate them. So this is from the International Crisis Group. Quote, South Sudan is facing an economic meltdown that could bring not only hardship but also political turmoil to a country that is already racked with both. The civil war in Sudan has severely disrupted oil exports, depriving South Sudanese coffers of petrodollars. That's the government's main source of revenue. South Sudan seceded from Sudan in 2011. But the young country, South Sudan, remains entirely dependent on its northern neighbor to get oil to international markets, using two pipelines to transport crude to Port Sudan on the Red Sea. Yet one of these pipelines, responsible for about two-thirds of South Sudan's oil exports, broke down in February and will require months of complex repairs that must be made amid active combat. Absent stopgap measures, the consequences for South Sudan will be dire. The government could run out of money, and the national currency's value could plunge. Chronic food shortages could worsen, presaging renewed instability and fighting. Regional and global partners should prepare to send emergency relief to South Sudan as they redouble efforts to end the war in Sudan. Okay, that's the report from the International Crisis Group. Sebastian, you want to take it from there? How would you describe, first of all, the situation in South Sudan? How is it?
Situation in South Sudan is not great in terms of, I think I could say, a climate change. Besides war in Sudan, creating blockage of oil flow through Sudan. But the main factor in their crisis is actually climate change, because there's a lot of, in the last 40 years, a lot of flooding. It will stay until the end of May, and then the rain starts, and the Nile bring in a lot of water, flooding, and then it destroys crops. So I think it has something to do with the climate change.
So climate change tends to bring not only hotter temperatures, but also more extremes when it comes to precipitation events. So longer droughts, and then when it does rain,
it's monsoon. Yeah.
Monsoon is what you described. Yeah. Okay. And so that's become kind of typical, it sounds like, for South Sudan.
Yeah.
And that can be disastrous, yes?
It is. It's going to be worse, actually, it seems.
I mean, I don't know what you do about that other than continuing to build better infrastructure. Yes.
The only way out is to educate the population so they can use the man-made rains or agriculture.
Okay.
Yeah.
When it comes to Sudan, very different situation. What is the latest there, Sebastian?
It's still dangerous because there are two rivals, two generals, one former militia and the other one former dependent minister of Sudan, the former regime. They're both fighting for the over the power, and they both have powers. I don't know where they acquire their weapons and supplies, but someone somewhere is supporting them to destroy that country. Sudan is completely destroyed. Khartoum is completely destroyed.
How many times in your life have you been to Khartoum?
Twice, 2007 and 2009.
What was the city like?
It was very modern compared to
very
South
modern
Sudan.
City, oh, yeah.
Modern city, well built. And when I flew out from Khartoum going to South Sudan, it was like two different planets. In Khartoum, you have, at that time, you have a student using a school bus, like here in the U.S., and while in South Sudan, the same country at that time, you have children walking to school, and in some cases going to undertree school. I don't know what was the problems, but it could be the reason why South Sudan become a separate state.
And yet Khartoum now, you say?
It's done.
Destroyed.
It destroyed. There's no government there, really.
I'm going to use a frame of reference that is on people's mind because we've been seeing the images. It looks like Gaza City, just destroyed buildings everywhere.
Yes, I think so.
Oh.
It's because I met few students in our, especially 40 girls in our high schools, and I asked them what they think about Khartoum now. They said it's done. They don't even think they will go back. They said if you finish high school here, we may find a way to get a scholarship to go to universities in South Sudan and live in South Sudan. Don't go back to Khartoum.
It's a tragedy.
Yeah, because when you have war, the most victim are women and children. The same case what happened in South Sudan many years ago. Children and women are mostly victim of war. So I think this is affecting Sudanese women and children.
What happens in terms of who is going to set the safety and the structure going forward? I mean, who's going to be in charge of Sudan?
At the moment, it's not known yet. I hope the United Nations would move in and take it over. Otherwise, they are going to destroy anything.
Are you concerned that the instability in Sudan could spill over and cause continuing problems for South Sudan?
No. In my opinion, it will not do that. What it will create for South Sudan is economic crisis because the blockage of oil will be completely damaged. And South Sudan will receive a lot of refugees from Sudan and that they have to help while they are helping them their own citizen. In this case, it will create a humanitarian crisis and food shortage.
When you were growing up, it was one country, yes?
Correct.
Sudan. So you grew up in the south of Sudan.
South of Sudan. Southern Sudan.
And now you are in South Sudan.
South Sudan as a country.
I ask that because there's a very tragic irony, it seems, in that when you were 9 years old and war came to your village, you became a refugee.
Correct.
You fled. In 2011, South Sudan became its own country.
Yeah. July 9, 2007.
You know the date, of course. Mm-hmm. And it has been a struggle, but it has persisted while its neighbor to the north, Sudan, is in a disastrous state. And now the irony, the tragic irony is that South Sudan will have to take on more refugees from Sudan when South Sudan has its own problems.
When South Sudan is still struggling to feed their own citizens. And to make things very complex is you still have a tie of love between the citizen of Sudan and citizen of South Sudan. If you meet, if a South Sudanese citizen meet a citizen of Sudan, they see themselves as brothers and sisters, even though politically are two different states. So that encouraged South Sudanese, even in South Sudan at the movement, to adopt the children from Sudan, like the children in our schools, are considered South Sudanese, even though they are from Sudan. Those 40 girls that go to our high school, and they deserve it.
Hmm. Judy, how often do you encounter people who, when you tell them, you know, some of the work that you do as the board chair for Building Minds in South Sudan, either have a very limited knowledge to begin with or would confuse Sudan and South Sudan?
They still are confused between the two countries. And I do say that there's a very big difference. And it's interesting because they'll say, well, are you safe in South Sudan? And fortunately, we're in a very remote part, so we're hard to find. And that kind of keeps us a little bit safer. But it's been interesting. I mean, I take every opportunity I can to bring it up and just inform people. And they are amazed at what we've been able to do. I am too. I'm always in awe because I never thought we'd get the first two classrooms built. We had nothing to show. We had no credibility. How do you fundraise when you don't have anything to show? But once the first two rooms went up, we just took off.
Why did you get involved yourself with this, Judy?
I had been involved with Sudan at the time, with a church in Richmond, Virginia. And it was actually through Women of Reformed Judaism throughout North America. And the people from Virginia had started a school there, and the girls were missing school once a week when they had their periods and they couldn't go to school. And there's nothing to wear, to use, or whatever. So the people came back and made these washable, renewable pads for them, sent them there. I heard about it, and I got about 30 women here making them in Rochester. I was able to raise money to get two treadle sewing machines down to this little village. And then somebody in the group said, well, don't you think you should go? I mean, to see how it's working and so on. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, ignorance is bliss and whatever. Long story short, I was able to go. And Sebastian's American mother knew that I was going on the trip. And she said, when you come back, you'll have to meet him. I said, okay, fine. And she brought him over. I knew a little Dinka. I put my pictures in and we were off in our own world. And then he told me about his dream and would I be part of it? And I thought, you never really have a chance in life to do something to me that's so profound. I mean, to help someone build a school in a remote village and so on. And I said, yes. And I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, 3 years or so or whatever. And it's been 14 years and it's been amazing. It's changed my life completely. And it's an honor and a privilege to work with him. He's so dedicated and so sincere about making things better. And we have over 3,000 children now, students, in our schools. And we started with just 249, you know, really a short time ago. It's remarkable. And it is so primitive. I felt like I was living a National Geographic special, really. I mean, the last two flights were seven of us on a plane. And the last one, we came down on a little postage stamp piece of ground, and you could see the children running out from the bush. And we landed, and I put my hand on what seemed like a plastic little window on this plane, and a little boy from the bush came and put his hand on mine outside, and I just lost it. I mean, it was incredible. I never in my life thought I would have an experience like that. And so when I came back and met him, it was just a perfect fit, and we've been going on ever since.
Sebastian, what does this relationship mean to you?
It meant a lot. I think in my aim, I think it was a blessing. I think it was a blessing. I'm so lucky that those who are involved never say, Sebastian, I have enough, and I'm going to sit aside now, bring another person. They are so involved, very involved. And luckily, some of our supporters, whom are not board members, including Bill Cook, former professor at SUNY Geneseo, gone there how many times now? I think 5 times with me to South Sudan. And this year he went in February, so we can dedicate it to girl high school for the girls. And he says, on my way to the village, he says, I'm going to say goodbye to Mana Bun. I'm 80 years old. I can't come back again. But after we went to the little children's school that is going to be built, he says, I'm coming back. He says, I'm coming back. So I think my life started horribly during war, but I think it's aiding good, because in life, we own nothing in life. You can be anything, but when you leave this world, you have nothing. But when you do a legacy, it's remain in life. That's what you own. That's what you really own. So I think they are helping us to build a legacy as a Rochester, not only Sebastian or Judy Short, as Rochester. Because they all knew that it's not Sebastian who is dedicated in fund, it's Americans. And they know all about Rochester, New York now, the people in our village, because I talk to them all the time, and I talk to the village ship. Mm. And many from our community supporters, mostly donors, I ask them to go, if you guys give us more fund than what I expected that you would give, I follow you. I will not mention this person's name. He live in Victor, New York. I talked to him for 2 years, pushing him to go with me. I said, you have been given for 8 years, every year the same amount. It's large amount, almost for the whole classrooms. And I said, you have to go and see. I cannot be the one telling you. We went to the village, and he came back to the United States, and he helped us build a women's center for women in the community. And he's doing more than what he dedicated at the beginning. Now, he keeps telling me, you didn't tell him enough about your village. I saw more than what he told us. And he wished to go back to the village. And he's older than Judy.
No, yeah. I'm older.
He's older than you. He's older than you.
I'm older.
Yeah, so I think it's a blessing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Sebastian Marundit, who is the co-founder and president of Building Minds in South Sudan. Judy Schwartz is the board chair for the organization, and now you know how Judy, who never would have told you 15 years ago that that's what she'd be doing, now you know why Judy is in a public radio talk studio telling this story and helping raise the funds that they're doing, trying to build next a pre-K to third grade school in Mayana Boom. And they're on their way, but they have a lot of work that has to be done. And after we take our only break, I want to talk to them about what realistically might happen in the future, because I feel torn. I hear these stories that are just amazing. And you meet someone like Sebastian, and you can't help but be, and I don't say this tritely, but you can't help but be really moved and inspired, and maybe even making you reevaluate how you contextualize certain hardships in your own life. Everybody has hardships. I'm not downplaying that, but boy, what you learn from this. And yet, then you still hear that there's 7 out of 12 million people in acute famine or have acute hunger in South Sudan, and they've got all kinds of other problems. And you think, how are we going to fix this systemically? They're doing brick by brick, donation by donation, one classroom at a time. And it is a hard, hard piece of work. So we're going to come back with them, and we're going to talk more about what the future may hold and how they're going to keep trying to make change. And they'll tell you how you can help if you want to. We'll come right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a new documentary explores the police shooting of a man who was having a mental health crisis in British Columbia, Canada. The man died. His sister says it shouldn't have happened. And now the new film is part of the Real Mind film series that comes to Rochester every year, exploring issues related to mental health. We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Even in our short break, you should hear the way Judy talks about Sebastian. When you meet someone for the first time and you really understand their story, it's easy to sort of be enchanted by them. But Judy has gotten to know Sebastian for years. And if there was, you know, some sort of other side that really disappointed you, you'd have seen it by now. And instead, boy, the way Judy talks about Sebastian, I think you're his biggest fan, Judy.
Oh, I am. He's remarkable. I'm in awe every single time. And we've probably gone out 400 times maybe to make presentations over all these years. And I never cease to be amazed by his story. I mean, it's a miracle.
Well, I want to ask Sebastian about how he contextualizes trauma, tragedy. You know, you were 9 years old when you were essentially chased out of your village in what was the south of Sudan, which is now the country of South Sudan. Your sister was 5?
Yes, she was.
You saw her die?
Yeah.
I don't know how you ever wake up a day and don't think about that. I mean, you and yet you brighten the room. I walked in here and, you know, you have this amazing energy to you. How do you do that?
Well, I look at it this way. In our village, I think we were the most fortunate family because some family lost their all family members. Some is half of their family. And in our case, we lost 2 out of 8, so we had 6 survive. So we see ourselves to be, even though we lost our family members, we're the lucky one. Yeah.
You lost your dad?
Yes, I lost my dad, my sister and my dad.
And your mother essentially said, you got to go, right?
Yes.
Like
Run
or be killed. Yeah. When you next saw her, she didn't know if you had still been alive. Is that right?
She didn't recognize me because I was huge with American cheeseburger and tall.
Big. I mean, because what was from it? 20 years later? 18 years later?
Yeah. From 9 years old and now you're 27. It was a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, we laugh, but I mean, that's also a shock for a parent. Imagine not seeing your 9-year-old.
Yeah. And I was big. I was skinny when I came to U.S. I was tiny. My waist was 32. Now I wear 40. That's different. So when I went back, she could not recognize me. And it was.
Do you eat an American diet?
I try. But those goodies, those cheeseburger and wings sometimes, they're tempting.
Cheeseburger and wings. What is the heart of Sudanese cuisine?
Well, the common food is acida, which is made out of sorghums. And sometimes acida with milk or acida with kada, which is a soup. Yeah. They don't really have that. Milk is kind of like the basic food, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, acida is what you said. Can you make it here?
Yeah.
Do you make it?
No, I was not taught how to cook. This is one of the things that this is one of the things that I like girls' education, because back in the days, and still is in some part of the country where children are not educated, or girls are the ones are taught to cook, do much of the work in the family. Boys that just take care of cows, they don't cook. And I feel bad about that. Also, there's a high rate of domestic violence against women. Mm. looking at it now, it's horrible. But back in the days, it would look like it's culture. You have to punish your wife to behave the way you want. It's like you're controlling another human being. And I was okay with it. But looking at it now and seeing how women are contributing to this, to American economics or American lifestyles, I think there's a need of ending domestic violence against women. Put women first and give them education they deserve. I had a lot of challenge in many cases. I was in local radio known as Tweet Mayadi Radio. It's a UN-sponsored radio. And the guy asked me, are you a woman or a man? You talk about girls' education. You talk about women, microfinance for women. You talk about agriculture, farming for women. You talk about pad for girls. Are you a woman or a man? I said, no, I'm a man. But if you doubt, you can just make research about me. It's because I love my mother. And this young girl has someone moms. And country's chi, like America, for example, is a female, is chi. If a country is chi and you're denying a woman education, then you're denying a country education. And I think I made that point clearly to the interviewer and those who are calling, that if a country is chi and they understand, you cannot refer a country he, you say she. That means a country is a woman. I also said when a child starts talking, they don't say daddy, no. They say mom. And one thing we all don't know, the day you die, you're 120 years old, you're dying, you say mommy. Even though you knew your dad exists.
You cry out for your mother.
For your mother. From the childbirth and to when you leave this world. If mom is that important in our salt, why not give mother a chance to education? And that's that point, actually, I think they understand it well.
What do you make of this story here, Judith?
He says this all the time when we go out. And even I mean, to schools, to children in schools. And they really do get it. They really do. I mean, the room is silent. I love to sit there because very often we're in an auditorium in a school. And I just love to sit like a fly on the wall and look out. And they are just taken by every word. I mean, they don't even blink their eyes when he talks. He can say things that we could never say. It makes such a difference when he is saying these things and the importance of education and women and so forth. And I think, I mean, he's making a huge difference, not only informing them about Under Tree School and so on, but this whole thing of respecting women and education for all. And he has really, here in this country, changed the minds of thousands and thousands of people. Yeah.
Well, when it comes to cultural change, let me just ask you one more question, and then I got a little bit of listener feedback for you. You are working very hard to make sure girls, especially in South Sudan, all people can have education, but girls especially, because girls have been denied. Do girls tell you that they want that, or is there apprehension? Is there an assumption that girls have that I shouldn't be doing this?
They want it.
They want it.
When we built a primary school for girls, it was 800 girls the same year registered to go to girls' primary school. Now we have two high schools. We have less than 500 at the co-ed high school. In the girl high school, we have 722 girls. That means they really want to learn. And to me, by educating mother, that woman will not allow her children to not go to school. She will be there. She will tell them exactly. Because I still remember what my mom told me when I was like a young age about life. Because children mostly listen to their mom when they were early age, 3 years old, 5 years old. They will listen to their mom. And the language their mom speak the same language they start talking. If mom can teach them multiple, let's say, alphabetical letters like A, B, C, D, they will get it quicker than their daddy. It could be a folk culture. It could be folk culture with popular culture. It could be the way I see in South Sudanese or in Dinka culture, could it be? Or Nilotic culture, I should say. But if a Dinka woman or a Nilotic woman give advice to her own children, they will get it. If your mom says, I'll beat you up later, you will really believe it, which means mom is the key to children's life. And if you educate that mom, first, she will not allow herself to be abused. She will speak out when she's educated. That ain't domestic violence against women. When she's pregnant, she will take medication that will help her be healthy when she's pregnant. When she have that child, she will give that child education they want. And that, so you have four things at once that you can invest when you're educating one girl. Children, her own life, and the family.
Yeah, remarkable. All right, well, let me get some listener feedback. We have a listener who points out that both Sudan and South Sudan have U.S. State Department do not travel advisories right now. It says the U.S. embassies have been closed. It is admirable that they take risk going there. Do they feel danger when they go? How do they prepare themselves to travel there? How are they received? What do the people think of America?
Well, in South Sudan, if you say you're from America or Israel or Norway or Canada, you get treated with respect. I have multiple people I wish they could listen to call in right now that have been. I asked Dr. Bill Cook, and I asked a guy that I will not reveal his name from Victor, New York, when they were in Manabun, would they feel safe or unsafe? They said safer than when I was in the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum, Sudan is closed because of the conflict, but not in South Sudan. It's open. I was there 2 months ago. It is open. I usually go to visit them before I leave South Sudan to the United States. So it could be a political statement because I don't know what politics stand for. I'm not a politician. I'm humanitarian. But there are a thousand and thousands of Americans in South Sudan. Some work for United USAID, some work for Mercy Corps, some are with Doctors Without Borders, some are South Sudanese American who have went back to teach in colleges, work for the government, and yeah. So anywhere I go, I meet American. Some happen to be South Sudanese American, some are American American in South Sudan.
Judy, any concern that you would have to travel to South Sudan in the future?
Probably not the safety so much as just the age and being able to endure it. It's a really hard trip, and it's hard being there.
Long trip, a lot of connections?
Yeah, yes. When I went with the people from Virginia, it was 5 flights, and that's a lot of airtime. When Sebastian goes, I think it's 2 or 3. I know he's asked me to go, you know, many times with him, you know, when he goes back on his yearly visit. But I was lucky the first time, and I think that going back would be a hard thing to do. I feel that I can offer him more by being here.
But again, it's not because you'd feel in danger.
No.
It's just because
physically,
at your sprightly young age,
right.
It's yeah. A lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Oh, yes. Oh, I would have no fears from, you know, political reasons. None at all.
Okay.
No.
Let me get a phone call from Hal calling from Livingston County. Hello, Hal.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, some time ago, 52 years to be more exact, I was a Stanford graduate student in western Tanzania along Lake Tanganyika, studying our closest relatives that were living in the forest there. And I felt obliged to, through connections, to give a talk at a residential middle and high school and about what we were doing, since many Americans saw these things on television, but obviously there was no television there. So I was invited and gave this talk, and there were about 400 students in the audience, all male. And what was so striking was, and it wasn't exceptional, that girls really didn't get a middle or high school education. And from recent contacts with a woman who made it out, was from Kenya, this hasn't changed that much in 50 years. So Africa has about 1.2 billion people. It's the second most populous continent, and it's growing at a phenomenal rate. And education for young children and young women especially is central to sustainability, especially given the extremes of climate change, especially given how migrants are leaving the Southern Hemisphere to the Northern Hemisphere, creating a lot of turmoil. So I really support what they're saying about Somalia as a possibly more general issue. I've never been in Nigeria, the most populous country since sub-Saharan Africa, but I assume many of these things are true there. So I wonder what your guests think about that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Hal. What do you think?
It's true. It didn't change much, really. And we're talking about 2007, when we have only boys in our first primary schools, and now we had to fudge with help from the presidency of the country and then the village chief to push girls to go to schools, and village chief asked us if you can build a separate school for girls that may help them to go. So it's not easy. Culturally, they are really pushed back. They are not told, like, don't go, but it seemed like they are getting pushed back. And then in some cases, there's arranged marriage where some girls get married early. And I told the girls in our high school, if your parents attempt that, let me know. I can defend you. We can go to court to help you. And fortunately, so far, no girls has been asked to do arranged marriage in our schools. So it's true. There's a lot of difficulties all over Africa. And our case was really, really bad because girls are a source of income in some families, and I think all of them. They do arranged marriage, and you have to pay cows, dowries. Even though they say it's dowries, to me, it's like you're selling a human being, really, exchange for cows. So that the only thing will end it is education. When the girls are educated, and I hope I will see one of them going to protest, I will be behind them. Or let's say creating a group that will fight to end dowries against dowries for buying girls, I'll be supportive of that. But in the meantime, being a South Sudanese American, legally, I cannot do that. But I can do it under the table when they're the one doing it. Mm. I can support them. Mm. It will help them in that.
When I was there, I remember one mother having her daughter's hand, you know, asked to marriage, and she said she has to get her education first, and then she can marry you. And that was remarkable. I mean, at that time, I mean, it was 2010, and it was remarkable. But to be honest with you, these villages need a Sebastian. They really do, mm-hmm. to come and show the importance of education for women, because there's no one there who thinks along those lines, because this is all they've known. But he's just changed the world there in May and Aboon. And it sounds silly, but they do need someone like him.
That will spread slowly on its own. But you want to accelerate that.
Oh, yes.
And that's what I mentioned. So let me close with this. Melissa wrote in to ask, what is the cost of building a new school? What's the price tag, Judy?
Oh, gosh, it changes a little bit every year. I think a room, correct me if I'm wrong, is 20,000.
Yes.
A classroom is 20,000.
What are you trying to raise right now? What do you need?
Well, for probably $250,000.
Okay.
For the pre-K through third.
For the pre-K through third. And so let me close with this. What you just described, every place needs a Sebastian in South Sudan.
They do.
And that would spur change a lot. Again, that's from the ground level up. Is systems change possible there? I mean,
It changed, but not much, because
it's tough, huh? Yeah.
Majority of leaders, those who are leading the country, all of them were freedom fighters fighting for separation of South Sudan. They were not trained to be civil servants. And the only way out is to educate the young one to take over that country and bring about prosper state, and then use the oil reserve and then gold mining to develop their agriculture and find a way that can be useful to grow crops like sorghum and maize.
It's also extremely primitive. I mean, there's very little running water. There's no electricity. So it's really no infrastructure. So you really have a lot of hurdles to jump, really, to make this all happen.
If you want to come to South Sudan, let me know, because so you can experience the 490 road from Wau to the village.
Well, last 30 seconds, Sebastian, you spend about half your year on the road sometimes, a lot, but you're still here in Rochester. Is this where you're going to stay? Are you going to split a lot of your time going forward?
Well, in the future, I'm hoping that I can get some young Americans who wanted to travel to Africa, so I can take them to South Sudan and ask them to take over building mine in South Sudan and then become their advisor, because I'm hoping to settle my life with my family in the years to come. Yeah, 10 years from now, I would have done my part. Yeah.
There you go. Well, good luck to you. If people want to learn more, once again, the website, Judy?
BMISS.org.
It's B-M-I-S-S. BMISS.org. That's Building Minds in South Sudan. Sebastian Marundit, an honor. Thank you for being here.
And thank you for having us.
And I want to thank Judy Schwartz, the board chair for BMIS, Building Minds in South Sudan. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
More connections coming up in just a moment.